as far as being the trail being your training. Yeah, absolutely. But if you run into problems, then that's just a sign from the body that there's something that needs to be worked on. In a way, you're just repatterning how the body wants to move, or how the body moves naturally.
Especially if your knee hurts, it's probably not your knee. It's probably somewhere else in your body that's out of whack, out of balance, that has, you know, caused that pain. Welcome back, Peanut Butter and Mountain listeners. So if you're looking to perform better in the mountains, this episode is going to be for you. Our guest today is what I like to call, and we'll kind of talk about this a little bit later. We'll see if you agree. But I like to call him a hybrid mountain athlete who's renowned for his multifaceted approach to outdoor fitness. So today, let's welcome Chase Tucker, a.k.a. Chase Mountains on YouTube, to the podcast. Welcome, man.
Thanks, Chad. Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate the name of the podcast. As soon as I saw it, I was like, yeah, that's a podcast I want to be on for sure.
Oh, yes, dude. I love it, man. There's nothing better than peanut butter and then the mountains, right? And so it's like, that's why I did it.
It's a good combo.
Yeah, it is. Well, like I said before the podcast, man, I've been following your YouTube content for a long time. And for folks that maybe haven't heard of Chase before, you know, he's been on YouTube for a number of years, and he does a lot of fitness stuff on there. He's also been sharing some different short films as well. And I just want to thank you for sharing your knowledge there, because there's not a lot of people in that hiking fitness space that really talk about that. A lot of them that I've seen on through hikes and things are like, the trail's going to get you in shape type of things like that, right? And I cringe when I hear that type of stuff. So yeah, man, I'm stoked to talk with you today. And like I said, I relate to you so much. And what I really see in you is that you're kind of what I like to refer to as a hybrid mountain athlete. Would you agree with that statement, or what would that statement, I guess, mean to you? I'm curious.
I'll definitely take that. Yeah. It sounds like a real sexy term. And I think it speaks to variety, which is what I really love. I don't like to coin myself as a hiker or a through hiker or even a mountaineer or an alpinist, but I do a little bit of everything. I also do a little bit of rock climbing. And the thing is, I'm not like particularly good at any of them, and I'm not particularly committed to any one sport. I just love being in the mountains in any shape or way, shape or form. And I like to utilize these different skills that I've built over the years to explore the mountains in different ways through different seasons. So having a bit of a, you know, not only a very expensive catalog of gear, but also the different skills that allow me to kind of do whatever the weather here in Spain allows me to do.
Yeah, dude, that totally makes sense. Yeah, so you can extend you being in the mountains basically all year, 365 days a year, essentially, because you now have all these different kind of skill sets that kind of can kind of take you through each season. What's kind of been your like recent, I don't know, what's your top sport right now, do you feel like, out of all of those? Like, what are you most interested in?
I'm probably most interested in ice climbing, because I've had a decent winter, and so I've had a couple of good sessions, and we had some good thaw freeze periods. So I've been ice climbing a little bit more than usual. And that came about because I just found a couple of really good partners that I vibed with really well. And they're a lot younger than me. They're like in their early 20s, and they're able to kind of push things, and we communicate really well. They're incredibly knowledgeable. So that, just by coincidence, you know, we met rock climbing. We just started chatting at the crag, and then he invited me out, and I was like, you know, I've got all the gear, but I'm hideously inexperienced being an Australian in ice. And so over the years I've done a little bit, but I kind of got a taste for it just in the last season. So I've been out a few times, and it's been super nice.
Now, are you like looking at maybe any kind of future goals where you kind of combine all of these disciplines into an objective? Because that's kind of like where I'm at right now. It's you know, I've learned to through hike. I know how to feed my body. I know how to trail run long distances, right? I know how to do some rock climbing. I know how to do some rope work and things like that. So for me right now, what I'm trying to do is kind of combine all those disciplines into maybe one objective that I can use, like, all of those skill sets. Are there any that kind of pop out to you in the future that you're interested in with that?
Yeah, so there's this idea that I have of combining ultralight hiking with long sort of ridge scrambles that don't necessarily need too much gear or too much rope, so not so heavy on the cams and gear, so that I could maybe take a short rope for rappels, but do some long ridges that could potentially link up for, you know, like 3 or 4 days, not entirely ridges for 3 or 4 days, but maybe linking a series of ridges just to stay up high. Yeah. Because I found that through hiking experience, you can really only sustain about 3 to 4 days of good food. And so that's kind of the limitations that have been placed on me for this idea. Mm. So this summer, that's what we're looking to do, actually with the same guys who are interested in the same type of climbing as me. And that would just allow for a big adventure that could be squeezed into a decent weather window and would be really adventurous and really kind of that fun, sketchy, perhaps type 2 fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I'm looking, that's what I'm super excited about this summer.
Well, and that's, you had a recent film kind of come out or documentary, I don't know what you would want to call it, but of you doing a ridge scramble, which was really, dude, it was very cinematic, and I love the drone shots and everything like that. So I'm thinking that's probably similar to kind of probably what you're referring to. And one thing I wanted to touch on, you said good food for 3 to 4 days or so. What do you mean by that?
Well, this could be a deep rabbit hole, but the thing is with a lot of hiking food is that it's you know, ultra processed, and it is quite hard to digest, and it's not very nutrient dense. Yeah. So again, that sort of 3 to 4 day window allows me to take like relatively fresh food and perhaps dried, you know, jerky or dried fruit, and still have like, you know, decent quality food rather than just eating ramen the whole time.
Dude, that's my issue with thru hiking. I, you know, someday I want to do the PCT. I'm looking at the map right here on my wall, but I don't know if I can eat that bad for 4 months.
It's not good for you. That's for damn sure. Like, all of this stuff is full of like seed oils, like canola oil, sesame oil, like all these hydrogenated oils that are, yeah, and there's a decent amount of science behind the correlation between a lot of diseases and all-cause mortality, right, and the introduction of seed oils, particularly in the States. I mean, it's just as bad here and all over the world, really. But that's one thing I've been really kind of a lot more strict. I've never really had a strict diet, but I've been very strict on myself in the last like few months in terms of eating really really good quality, like actual food. I feel way better.
I was just gonna say, what's the difference? I mean, do you feel quite a bit of big percentage difference than before?
Yeah, far better mood, better sleep, a better handling of my emotions, my emotional state in terms of being able to being able to respond rather than react, and in terms of the choices that I make on a daily basis about how I spend my time, this is all very unscientific, but it's just the things that you notice when you start to pay attention that are important, I think, and it doesn't necessarily have to be so scientific or so deliberate, but you can make some assumptions about the changes that that happen when you start to change what you put in your body, and whether it's placebo or not, who knows, but the fact is if you feel better, you feel better, and then you keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, well, and that's probably a really good segue into some of the breath work stuff that you've been doing as well and kind of integrating into your fitness routines and your trainings and stuff like that. So I'm super interested in this. We were talking off podcast about NSDR, which is Andrew Huberman brought it up, and, you know, napping type of stuff. It's not really napping, but I don't know. You probably know way more about it than I do. But I'm just curious on, some of your insights on, you know, breathing techniques, how you've been integrating that into your mountain activities, and like the benefits you've been seeing from that. Can you kind of walk us through that?
Yeah, so I get questions very, very regularly about how can I improve my fitness for hiking? And what they are usually referring to is how can I hike to the extent that I don't have to breathe so much, that I don't have to stop and catch my breath. That's what hikers are talking about when they're talking about fitness, right? The thing is that the way that you breathe during rest, during sleep, will not really change with the onset of increased cardiovascular fitness. Like with typical running, high intensity drills, we can make some improvements in fitness, but it's not really going to change the way that you breathe during rest. On the flip side, if you improve the way that you breathe during rest, during sleep, during work, during a podcast, that will have an effect on how you breathe in higher intensity activity. So it's, I don't want to get caught up in terminology, but usually when people are asking about fitness, what they're really referring to is respiration. And so I've dedicated the vast majority of my research time in the last couple of years for learning and experimenting with the Oxygen Advantage method. And I've interviewed the founder, Patrick, on my YouTube channel. And I went through a couple of different courses, and I'm now an advanced instructor in that. And so now, over the last 2 years, I've been sort of integrating that into my programs and in my coaching, with incredible results, by the way.
Interesting. So you're saying, so you teach them more how to breathe at rest, which then translates to better, essentially, cardiovascular fitness when they're actually doing hiking and stuff like that. How do you do that? Or what is it, diaphragmatic breathing type stuff? I'm very, very ignorant to this. So, I mean, by all means, crush me with what I'm saying in my terms. But, yeah, how is it that you're doing that?
Mostly, I make pre-recorded audios and videos. You could think of they're kind of like meditations.
Sure.
Where I would record an audio or a video and give it to my clients. And so that's the basis level, like learning how to breathe at rest. Then we can get into more intense stuff when we can actually start to integrate breath holds and hypoventilation, low meaning low, so breathing less whilst doing an activity like hiking or climbing or running or whatever. So the idea there is to breathe less at rest. And then also, as you increase in your activity, to also breathe less. Mm. And so what that brings about is mainly biochemical changes in the body. So there's an interesting relationship between carbon dioxide and oxygen, that when we disturb those blood gases and when we improve the body's ability to tolerate carbon dioxide better, we then are able to do more work with less respiration.
What the heck? That makes sense, right? That makes sense. You just, you take it for granted, right? I mean, because you've just been breathing all your life. So you're just like, oh, I just breathe, right? I think in one of the videos I think I was watching, or maybe, I don't know, I can't remember if it was yours or not, but would this help folks at altitude as well?
Yeah, potentially. What most people are worried about when they're at altitude is altitude sickness and the symptoms that go along with that, which is fair. We can't really definitively say that you're going to suffer less from altitude by doing these practices. However, we can simulate a low oxygen environment through the training. So it is a form of simulated altitude training, simply by breathing less. And so the more that you practice that, like, you know, athletes will do this. They'll go to Denver or whatever, and they'll have a training season there because it's essentially a lower oxygen environment, right, and their body's adapting to that. Mm-hmm. And so that's not going, that's going to be far more effective than just doing what I do, which is like, you know, half an hour a day, where we're disturbing blood gases,
mm-hmm,
and doing reduced breathing during exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So over time, yeah, we see improvements in breathing, and improvements in breathing will relate to better performance on the mountain and perhaps better utilization of the limited amount of oxygen at altitude.
Mm.
But it's very early in the piece here. There's not a whole lot of research that's been done on it. So it's very difficult for me to say, and perhaps irresponsible of me, yeah, to say that, yeah, this is great for altitude.
Yeah.
But I think the reality is that you improve your breathing at sea level, then likely that will be maintained in altitude as well.
Totally.
And that's been my experience.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Let me ask you this. Do you use mouth tape when you go to sleep?
Yeah.
Do you? Yeah. Have you noticed a difference with that? I mean, you have to. Using it.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's really hard to say whether the improvements come from the practices that I do, whether it's from nutrition, whether it's from training, or
yeah,
or taping the mouth, or any other, you know, sauna, cold, all the other things, right, that I do. But it's if you think about the amount of time that we spend in sleep, you know, it's a third of our lives, and I like to think about it like, well, you get 8 hours of free breathwork training without doing anything, cool, other than putting a tiny bit of cheap tape on your mouth.
That's cool.
And, you know, you don't need to buy, like, I get ads for these mouth tapes, and perhaps they're a little bit better with the type of adhesive they have or whatever, but I just use like regular, like Leuco tape.
Oh, do you really?
Like physio tape. Yeah, yeah.
Does it rip your lips?
I buy packs of 20 of them. No.
No.
My girlfriend uses it every night, and she has quite sensitive skin, and she doesn't complain about it. So, if it's not bothering her, then it's not going to bother most people. Gotcha. She's pretty picky.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. Dude, that's hilarious. Well, this is cool. I mean, just kind of understanding so far in this conversation, you have a very holistic, obviously, approach to your health and like your longevity and stuff like that. And if I'm not mistaken, you're almost 40, right?
Yeah, I'm 40 in January.
Dude, you 100% look at least 5 years younger than your age, which is always, I feel like, a
very kind.
Yeah, it's always a very big compliment, though. I mean, because I think that is a compliment for how you take care of your body holistically, you know. And I'll get that I'm 26 or 27 or something like that, and I'm like, dude, I love that. You know, it's like fitness has been such a big part of my life, and really being healthy the last 5-6 years has been a big part of my life. So it's cool to see. I mean, you can see right now, folks, it's paying off, right? It's paying off. So
yeah, it's probably just good genes as well, you know?
So humble.
My dad's like 70 something, and he's still in pretty good shape.
Oh, really?
And so that's also, you know, got a lot to do, yeah, with it as well. I'm perhaps lucky in that sense.
Well, dude, I mean, again, dude, it's very obvious you take care of yourself. I mean, can you, like, I mean, if you go to his YouTube channel, you've got, you know, a ton of different, again, walkthroughs of training techniques, fitness programs, things like that. You run your own fitness program, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But what is your typical training program for... I mean, the fact of the matter is you're doing, again, a lot of things in the outdoors. So, you know, if you were doing just a through hike, you'd probably be different than if you were training to kind of be this multifaceted person in the outdoors. So what is your training regimen currently? Like, how do you break it down day by day? What are you looking to increase? And yeah, I'm just curious because it is kind of difficult. It's like hard to focus on one thing at, you know, when you're doing so many things in the outdoors.
You might be surprised by this, but I don't really do a lot of structured exercise in terms of what you would expect from an average kind of personal trainer or a strength and conditioning coach. So really at the moment, I know my body really well, and I know my personal needs, and I know my strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And so I have a decent strength base because I was a strength coach spending, 12 hours a day in a gym for 6 years lifting weights. So I'm pretty happy with the level of strength that I have, both in my lower body and upper body. So I don't tend to do a lot of strength training. I'll go through phases where I'll do maybe 6 to 8 weeks of a fair bit of deadlifting and the typical stuff. But, right now I'm spending a lot of my time and effort getting better at relaxing.
Mm.
Because over the years, I've sort of discovered that I do have quite a lot of just resting tension in my body for one reason or another. And so I spend a lot of time getting better at relaxing whilst moving.
Mm.
So you could look at what I am doing currently, and I'll put a video out soon that sort of shows in more detail what I'm doing, but it's very similar to, if you saw it, you would think it's Tai Chi or Qigong.
Sure.
So what I'm aiming to do and what I'm spending a lot of my time on now is really marrying up the Eastern traditions with both yoga and Tai Chi Qigong with Western science, to try to understand how and why and if it would be beneficial. And for me so far, it's been incredibly beneficial.
Mm.
And it's not to say that this is the most optimal thing to do. Like, it's going to be different for everybody. Mm. But for me personally, that's what I know I need to focus on. So, yeah, my average day usually starts with like a 15, 20 minute kind of Tai Chi Qigong inspired movement sequence.
Okay.
And I'll generally follow that up with a little bit of just reduced ventilation, sort of calm breathing. So breathing less than I would ideally like to.
Mm.
And that brings on the kind of stress response from the body because you're holding on to a lot more carbon dioxide. But then you kind of use this manual override where you teach yourself, you're like, yep, I'm feeling the stress from not breathing, but I'm also calm. And this plays in really well to climbing and mountaineering. Dude. Because right. it's just teaching you how to relax. And
sure,
what happens when someone is hanging on?
Oh, dude!
And they're over climbing and they're getting all this tension in their muscle. What's the belayer saying? Relax.
Yeah.
Like, what do you need? Just take a moment, take a breath. And so that's kind of what I'm practicing. Other than that, it's walking, running, enjoying myself, doing the thing. Like doing the thing, man. Like, getting out and hiking and trying to get out every weekend.
Yeah.
And it's not just, I don't really consider that training. That's just fun. Like, I go out and do it. But obviously, this is what I'm training for. So it's training in some respect, but it's certainly not structured really.
Interesting. So you're not doing too much. I mean, sounds like you do some periodization of weight training, but for the most part, you're not really touching weights in the gym, lifting weights in the gym.
Not currently. If we dial back 6 months ago, I was hitting the gym every day.
Interesting.
And in probably 2 to 3 months, I'll be doing the same. I'll go back to literally, I'll get a gym membership and I'll lift weights for 8 weeks.
How do you
just to stay on top of the strength?
I was going
to
say, how do you periodize that? I mean, is it kind of around your objectives of what you want to do for the year type of thing? Or how do you figure out that?
I don't really pay that much attention to periodization, to be honest. I will, you can program deload weeks and you can get really nitty gritty about the details. But at the end of the day, your progress is going to be determined by your lifestyle and your routines.
Hmm.
And usually I'll find that there will be some week there where I'll have to be away for a trip or, I'll take a holiday with my partner and my family or whatever.
Sure.
And I won't. And I'll just have like a natural deload week. So I really don't fuss over the details, and I don't fuss over the details with my clients. What I focus on is habits and routines and making sure the work gets done. Like when I am, doing heavy strength-based training, it's very simple. I walk into the gym and I lift things up and I put them back down. And I'll continue to do that until I'm tired. So it's real simple. Yeah.
dude. I get that, man. I know, like, when I used to lift heavier in college and stuff, people would be like, oh, man, how do I lift like you, or how do I look like you? I'm like, I mean, it's pretty easy, dude. You just freaking select a couple exercises and you keep going until it hurts. You have to let it down on the ground. I mean, it's not rocket science, you know.
People try and make it rocket science, yeah. Though. That's the thing. Like, they get very caught up in the details, because there's a lot of people like me who are, you know, begging for your attention and putting lots of complex information out there. But at the end of the day, it's much more important, you know, have two good routines. One that's like an upper body dominant one and a lower body dominant one.
Yeah.
Fucking repeat them.
Yeah.
Repeat them and repeat them and don't change it. Like, my clients come to me and they're like, oh, I need to update my program. No, you don't need to update the program. You need to go into the gym and you need to lift the weights.
Absolutely.
Just stop changing the program.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's it.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Uphill Athletes. They have a really, really good book.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So I have taken a couple of their workouts, like their muscular endurance workouts for my lower body and my upper body, actually. They have this Ice Beast workout. I actually just did the Ice Beast yesterday. You done that one? Nice. That one is.
No. I used to do that stuff a long time ago, and like a lot of their work informed what I do. I've started to source information from different people, obviously, but I have a huge amount of respect for Steven and Scott. Yeah.
Dude, they know their shit. I mean, book, I mean, if I could require one book for anybody to read before they get into mountaineering or anything like that, and they really want to look at fitness and stuff, like, it would be Training for the New Alpinism. I love that book, and I constantly am going back into that. But yeah, they're freaking ME workouts, man. They will leave you on the floor.
Yeah. And a lot of the theories that they go into in quite a lot of detail in the book is still holds up. And like, that book's been around for a long time, and they managed to circumvent a lot of the hype that was around the the high intensity interval training that happened around the time that book was released. And they were just like, what's this? There's no such thing as a free lunch.
That's it.
And it's like,
yeah, it was that article from a guy that tried to get a free lunch by just doing HIIT training all the time. And he realized that he just was still getting smoke zone 2 long duration stuff. He just couldn't sustain it. It was a different type of training. You're totally right. Yeah, I remember that article.
Yeah, and that portion of the book really was the beginning of me understanding how important nasal breathing was. I think that was really the first time that I had read detailed literature about the importance of zone 2 cardio, breathing through the nose, what they refer to in at least my version of the book was conversation pace. And that informed my training for a really long time. And from there, I got into the work of Dr. Philip Maffetone. I still am a huge fan and a proponent of his work. And that was really, I remember him saying something a few years ago, or at least I read it in a book. He was like, and I'm misquoting this terribly, but he was like, eventually, if you learn to breathe correctly, you will not have to worry about long-term chronic injuries like chronic muscle tension, joint pain, that kind of thing. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty bold statement, bro. Like, this is maybe 8 years ago. But now, like, with what I've understood, I'm like, he's actually probably right as far as I'm concerned. And with the experience that I've had from myself and my clients, it's not to say that it's the magic pill for everything, because there's no magic pill, but it is very, very clear the role that the diaphragm plays as a stabilizing muscle in the body. And so you simply cannot start addressing muscular imbalances and postural issues without first being able to recruit the diaphragm, simply because of the fact that it stabilizes the pelvis and the rib cage. And if your two major skeletal bodies are out of whack because the diaphragm isn't stabilizing them correctly, then all of this little, you know, these ones that you're doing band work and all this physio stuff is going to be completely pointless unless we first identify that there's no respiratory issues and there's no issue with the diaphragm. If you fix the diaphragm, if you get it to amplify the diaphragm correctly and properly, the likelihood is that the pelvis and the ribs are going to be stabilized. That's the center of the body, and it can flow outwards from there. And that's without even talking about what's happening at the scapula, at the collarbone, with the upper respiratory muscles, with neck issues. It's phenomenally important. And so why would I continue to spend all of my time on periodization and all the fancy stuff when I could actually put more time and attention into learning how to breathe properly? And people will be like, oh, I don't need to learn how to breathe. Yeah, you do. Because you're probably breathing through your mouth half the day. You're snoring at night. And the sad thing is that people that breathe in that way often will be more reactive and more stressed and more anxious, and they will find it, they will have limited ability to focus and take in new attention. So it's like this, it's a cycle that continues. And to say that breathing isn't important simply because it happens naturally without us doing anything about it does not mean that we can't improve it.
So do you kind of think about training the diaphragm as a muscle?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot, very large muscle. Yeah.
So, cause
it's not typically what we would think of as a muscle, cause it's very different in how it works. But yeah, you could think about breathing as strength training for the diaphragm.
Yeah. Okay. Like is there a way to like expand your chest cavity a little bit larger, or I don't know, like expand your chest cavity a little bit larger with this?
Ian Macro.
That's him. Yeah. Yeah. So I was,
he's excellent.
Yeah. So he's got, and so actually I was going to ask you about this too, is he talks a lot about CARs, or controlled articular rotations.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if you do any of that. I actually do it every single morning. I just go through a little routine, and I actually, now I'm starting to do it with like little wrist weights and stuff, you know, and then put them on my ankles as well. Mm-hmm. But do you do a lot of CARs? Do you do that in your stuff?
What I would do probably wouldn't be categorized under the strict definition of that.
Yeah.
But if you saw me doing what I'm doing, it's very similar, very, very similar result.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you're doing is, if you're relaxed and you're moving with respect to how muscles naturally shorten and tighten, if you are using momentum and gravity and consciously aiming to do that without creating more muscle tension, then in a way you're just repatterning how the body wants to move, or how the body moves naturally. And this is what I'm really interested in, because there's you know, thousands and thousands of years in history with this stuff from the East, but it's not very well understood by the West. But thankfully now it has been. There's a bunch of different physiologists that are matching up this the information that we have scientifically with the history of things like yoga and Tai Chi and Qigong.
Man, this is so interesting, because I've just kind of realized how maybe niche this stuff can be, because you know Ian. It's like, and I've communicated him quite frequently when I was doing his program and stuff, and he was very helpful to me. I had seen, well, he was on YouTube as well. He's been on YouTube for a while with some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of funny, like, how kind of niche this can be.
It's a small world. It's cool that you mentioned him, as I don't know him personally, but I do follow him fairly closely, and I have a great deal of respect for the work that he puts out.
Yeah.
And from what I can see, it seems to be very like pretty much self-informed through practice and observation of human movement, which is very different to how typical strength coaches obtain their information, because most of what we know about the human body has been determined through dissections and observing the dead body, the corpse. But a dead body doesn't move. And it certainly, if you do move it, it moves very different to a live human body. So the study of human movement is very, very separate from the typical world of strength and conditioning, which is mainly based on understanding the body through dissection.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's cool. I'll have to send him this clip. He'll be pretty stoked about that, man. That's cool.
I'd be stoked to be on his radar. I got a huge amount of respect for him. But please, if you're interested in this stuff, go and have a look at Ian Macro. He's phenomenal.
Yeah, no, I'll connect you guys too as well after this podcast. But
sweet.
Yeah, man.
Cool.
So I guess I'm kind of curious. Well, two things I'm curious about. One I really want to jump into. How do you risk in the mountains? Okay. So I feel like the risk between a ridge scramble and a through hike is different, right? And as I have progressed through my, I don't know what you want to call it, my mountain journey, I have moved towards, I guess, essentially more riskier things, if you want to call it that, right? How do you think of risk nowadays? You're 40 years old. Going to be 40, right? You have a girlfriend. Sounds like, you know, dad is still around. How do you think about risk now when you're going into the mountains? Wanted to pop in here quick to tell you guys about something that you are gonna absolutely love. So for a limited time, I'm actually offering my free outdoor goals Notion template. I'm actually selling this on Etsy for $8. But I'm offering it free for everybody that's listening to the podcast right now for a limited time. I'm not sure when I'm going to be taking this down. What this is storing all of your information, like your flights, the dates that you're going to go, your calendar, your beta for the adventure, the partners you're going with. It assembles everything all in one area. There's no more fumbling around with trying to cross-reference notes that you got, that you copy and pasted off of a blog, on your Word document, but then you also have flights on your phone. It's all gonna be in one place. What I like to do with it, I like to create all my goals ahead of time, block out all those dates. I know when I'm gonna be going, I know what the goal is. It's templated, so you have all the things that you need to fill out, like permits and everything, in the actual database. So no worrying about having to recreate everything. And here's actually a quick email that I just received randomly from a person that actually picked it up. He said, "Your info has been the most helpful out of all of the hikers on various platforms that I follow. Specifically, your outdoor goals Notion template has been great, not just for planning purposes, but for motivation, as I can see my next year's adventures in a snapshot. I now use Notion for organizing pretty much everything in my life, including work." So that's what we're trying to do for you guys. We're trying to help you out. And so again, I'm offering this free outdoor goals planning list template for free for a limited time. Grab it now in the show notes below. Back to the episode.
I think about it increasingly more as I get older, for sure. I think I used to be fairly nonchalant about exposing myself to falls and to risks. And I've been perhaps lucky enough to have close calls in lots of different situations. I've had very long falls, like, you know, 20-foot falls onto the ground. And
really?
And done a... Yeah.
Scrambling? Or what?
So, no, just a bad belayer who's a dear friend of mine. But yeah, so I fell on him and I broke his L4, I broke his spine when I fell on him.
Shut
so,
up.
I know what it's like to fall for what feels like forever and then eventually crash into someone, thankfully. But he got his, he paid his price, but he's fine. He climbs much harder than I do now. He recovered very well. So,
wow.
Yeah, I've touched the risk in lots of different ways, and as I get older, I'm certainly more conservative. But being in the situation of not having kids, I definitely have the advantage of being able to responsibly absorb a little bit more risk than the average person my age, because they would have kids, and I do plan on having kids, and it'll probably happen in the next few years. So I've got a couple more years where I can kind of push the boundaries a little bit. And at which time I'll probably reduce my exposure to certain things. But particularly in the climbing world, or even in the scrambling world, when you're in more risky terrain, risk assessment is the fundamental, and it's a huge part of the excitement. It's a huge part of the intellectual part of climbing, and also the emotional part of adventuring and climbing as well, because you're constantly dealing with your own internal dialogue about the acceptable level of risk that you're willing to take. So it's a dance. It's a beautiful dance. And like I said, a couple more years of risking, taking a higher level of risk, I think I've got, and then I'll probably calm down and do things that are a little bit safer, at least, and probably until I'm, you know, the kids are older, and then I can get back into it again.
Very articulate. No, that was really, really great insights. Have you ever thought, because I've thought about this too, is like, so if I do have kids, because I like what I'm doing right now, but if I do have kids, I'm going to have to, like you're saying, like take it down a notch or a couple bars, right? Hmm. Have you thought about like what specific activities would still light your fire? Because you still need to be, it still needs to be engaging for me. I mean, if I'm going to go out to the mountains and stuff, like I still need to have some sort of engagement and be stoked about what I'm going to be doing out there, right? And like, I'm just curious, like if
I think
any...
the vast majority of the stuff that I do is still well within the acceptable realm, even as a father, I would say.
Sure.
The beauty of the Pyrenees is that there's very low objective danger. Sure, if you go out in winter, there can be avalanche risks and stuff, but they max out at about 10,000 feet, and there's a few glaciers, a few big glaciers, but they're not very busted up, and so it's a playground, man. Like, it's so beautiful, and so accessible, and very, very predictable weather patterns. So I'm very, very comfortable in that environment, and also because I know it very well. But if I was to go to the Alps even, which is experiencing a lot of turmoil in terms of the temperatures, that's a risk that I'm probably not even willing to take now, because it's so unpredictable. And you know, I used to take pretty regular trips to the Himalayas as well.
Hmm.
And that's not something I'm too happy with in terms of the risk for myself at the moment. So I'm really just enjoying my local playground, and I'm very, very comfortable with what's on offer there. And there's very few things that I feel like would be irresponsible, other than like sketchy new routes that aren't very well protected.
Yeah. No, that's so interesting, because I had a very high performing buddy. He's been to the Himalaya now a couple times. And the last time he went last year, he basically said, I don't know if I ever want to go back. He said, man, it was kind of like, there's like a lot of death around. I don't know, is what he kind of said the Himalaya was. I mean, they didn't have anybody in their group that died, fortunately, but, you know, they lost like a horse in a crevasse, and they, I don't know, it was all this wild stuff. And he just said, man, I don't know if it's worth the risk over there anymore. And you know, when you said the Himalayas looks like a beautiful place, I'm not sure if I would, not sure if I could ever go there either.
Yeah. I've had the unfortunate experience of attempting to revive someone, and eventually having to put them, shove their head into a helicopter, not an ambulance helicopter, but just like a regular tourist helicopter. And so I fully understand what he's getting at there. There's certainly a lot more death, and the higher that you climb, the higher you go, the more death is apparent. And, you know, that may excite some people for obvious reasons, but it's not something that really drives me. I don't get excited, or it's not a positive experience, and it's not a heroic thing to be close to death in my opinion. So yeah. I'd rather just do things that are, you know, fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fun. Fun adventures that are like, a little bit risky, a little bit spicy here and there, but you know, at the end of the day, you can drive home and
right.
hug your family.
Right. Sorry, I'm getting a freaking face. Whoops. 1 second. I'm getting a FaceTime call here. Sorry.
Jerk.
You still see me?
Oh, yeah? Good.
Okay.
Yeah, man.
Okay.
Yeah, 1 second.
That came out of nowhere, dude. I just got blown up. Dude, that was so weird because it connected to my... Because I have an iPhone, so it connected to my computer, too. And I was just getting the ring of the phone in my ear as you were talking. I was like, holy shit. Okay, hopefully that'll be fine.
I didn't hear it, so real good.
Okay, sweet.
We're back online.
Okay, let me... anyway... One thing that I would recommend...
I can pick up...
What's that?
Go ahead.
One thing...
go ahead.
I don't know if you've ever heard of it, but The Whirl, it's called. W-U-R-L. It's called The Whirl. Wasatch Ultimate Ridge Linkup. So it's a 43-mile ridge linkup in the Wasatch, in Utah. It's like right outside of the city, Salt Lake. And, I mean, it's... I haven't done it yet. Mediocre amateurs, I'm sure you've seen them on YouTube before. Yeah, they have a really good video on it. Danny did it. But if you're looking into ridge linkups and stuff, I think you would love that, The Whirl. So might be something to write down.
Yeah. I'm gonna check it out for sure.
So I do
plan on getting over to the States at some stage as well, like the details are fuzzy at the moment. But I'd really like to go to trail days and some of these other events, not only just like a businessy networking thing, but also right. There's so many characters that I would love to meet, like in person. Like I've been on Emery's podcast. I love him.
Me too.
Well. I'd love to meet him, and I'd love to meet Darwin and Dan and Kyle and all these guys that I who are my peers, because I don't have that many people on this side of the planet who are doing this in English, and so that's where I feel like my people are at. I definitely want to get over there at some stage.
Oh, dude, yeah, heck yeah. I was me and Emery have chopped it up quite a bit. He's been I think he's been on my podcast a couple times, three times or something like that. I've been on his a couple times. Real funny guy, real good dude. He's got really good opinions too that we chopped up.
Yeah, there. I'm going to have to hit him up for dad advice as well. Like we were talking earlier about the acceptable level of risk and what you do when you have kids. And I think because he's got kids of various different ages, so he's sort of, I think he's now able to take them out and do some trips as well, which I'm actually super excited about.
Really?
I would welcome the opportunity to calm things down and to be in an environment where you have these beautiful little beings that are so curious to everything around you, and it would just enable you to see things with a completely different perspective. And so I'd welcome that.
Yeah, I'm still on the fence about kids. I don't know, we'll see. I got some time. I'm 32.
It's a difficult thing, hey?
It is, man. It's like,
it's also it's
like, do I want to, when do I like that you're kind of in that mindset of like, yeah, I would welcome lowering it down a little bit, being a little more calm, right?
Mm.
And I don't know if I'm there yet, but I could see myself eventually getting up there. I think one of the things when I asked you, like what are maybe some of the hobbies that you would take up if you had kids, I think I would probably get involved in hunting actually more, because I like love the organic meat. I mean, there is nothing better than some elk steak. I mean, you're talking about nutrition. Oh my God. And so, I think that would be a little bit more low key for me. And right now, when I think about hunting, I'm like, oh, but there's so many other cool things to do in the fall. It's great rock climbing. It's great this and that. And so, I've been trying to kind of figure that stuff out. But that's cool to see, kind of hear where you're at with it.
Yeah. I've never really thought about doing that with a kid. But, like, I guess I grew up with, guns in the house, small guns in the house, and I would like shoot birds in my backyard.
Yeah, oh yeah, we all did.
Not native birds, like pest birds. Yep. But I think there's a lot to be learned from hunting as well. I would be super interested to get into it because breathing is a huge component of that in terms of like when you pull the trigger, being totally like you need to be totally relaxed and calm, I imagine, when you're and quiet, you know. And so that being in that situation where you are required to be perfectly still and to observe nature, I think there's a lot of negativity around hunting. Mm-hmm. But there's also a lot of positive aspects for it as well. And like you could talk about like bow hunting.
I was going to say, you would love bow. You would love bow hunting. If we're talking about breathing and concentration, you would love it. Love it.
Mm. It's just every time I get excited about something like this, I'm like, oh, can I have another hobby? Like,
oh, me too.
Can I have another closet full of gear? So I have to take that into account whenever I'm getting too excited about a potential new sport. But yeah, the hunting in the Pyrenees is like pretty good. Mm-hmm. Like we don't have those like the big game, mm-hmm. but we have it like a decent sort of community of hunting here. And so yeah, potentially something I'll get into. Let's see. And I was a vegetarian for 8 years. And so if you'd have said that to me a couple of years ago, I'd be like, nah, I don't want to kill animals.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's part of human nature. Like we are killers, mm-hmm. like it or not. We are, you know, we do benefit from eating meat, mm-hmm. and we've done it forever. So it's something that, you know, you can deny for sure, and I didn't deny it for a long time, and I have full absolute respect for vegans and vegetarians still, obviously. My girlfriend is a vegetarian, but it's there is something very primal and very very beneficial in it for sure.
Yeah, so you kind of, what was it that kind of made that come full circle for you, do you feel like?
It was mainly just living in Spain and having very limited access to vegetarian food because the culture here is very much based around meat. Mm. And so I eventually just kind of gave in because I found that I wasn't really able to feed myself with the quality that I would like to without meat. Mm-hmm. And I found that I was eating a lot of processed food and supplementing, you know, that if you have loads of time, then of course you can have a very healthy vegan or vegetarian diet, but it does require a lot of time and effort. And I simply, sadly, don't have the time for it. And it's just easier to eat, you know, good organic meat.
Yeah.
Well, that would be cool to get you into hunting. I mean, Emery's a good resource with that too, I'm sure. He's talked a lot about hunting before. And so he's a good guy to hit up too about it. But yeah. That's cool.
Every now and then I've trained hunters as well. Mm. A few hunters have come to me over the years and it's always really interesting because the predominant trend is to go ultralight now with hiking. So most people are interested in lowering their base weight, but hunters are just like, yeah, I'm rocking out with like 30 pounds or 40 pounds or whatever. And then coming back with a deer.
Right.
So you definitely need an enhanced level of strength and conditioning in that case. But in my case, for what I'm doing now and for probably what most through hikers are doing, there is, sure, you need a base of strength, but it's a very limited, you don't need a lot. What you need more is balance of strength, where the stress is being distributed evenly through the body rather than on one particular point. And so if you have really, really developed quads, but your glutes and hamstrings aren't equally and opposingly strong.
That's me.
Then that could potentially result in overuse injuries.
Interesting. Yeah. What is, we kind of talked about this before the podcast, but what's your opinion on the trail will get you in shape for thru hikers? That quote.
If you're lucky, it certainly will. And, if you have perfect biomechanics and you've generally remained active and you've been doing a lot of sport and regularly moving, not doing your desk job, not driving a lot in a car, not experiencing a lot of lifestyle stress, then yeah, probably, like, it'll work out pretty well. But the reality is, for most people, is that's not the case. We are experiencing elevated levels of stress constantly. Many different new stimuluses and exposures to substances and practices and lifestyles that we haven't done a lot of research on. And so that presents difficulties for the body. And when you expose yourself to doing 20 miles a day, those difficulties will appear in problems. And what I do is I try and foresee those problems based on people's habits and lifestyles to assume, okay, where would this likely weak link happen? Mm. Would it likely happen in the foot? Would it likely happen in the hips, knees, or lower back? And how can we mitigate that as a part of a preparation? Mm-hmm. Rather than my previous approach for many years was just like, hey, let's get strong as fuck and let's get you super, super fit. But now it's more about how can we balance this system out such that it distributes the stress evenly.
Interesting. Okay. So you're kind of almost assessing for places that might be a little bit weaker that you can kind of enhance a little bit and make it a full body, multifaceted approach rather than just focusing on let's do 100,000 step ups because you're going to be going up the mountain type approach.
Yeah, I did that for years. That was the basis of my training for years, both for myself and what I prescribed for other people. So it was very much based around, your typical kind of squats, lunges, deadlifts, core strength with high frequency of weighted step-ups or, you know, hill repeats or whatever. And that is still a huge part of what I do. Once we've identified that we've limited the potential risks and I've injured many people by providing a program that is quite high intensity that is available on my website for a small fee. And then without me having a, and without me doing a proper assessment of their health, they potentially run into issues. And that's why I don't particularly promote those older programs. And in some cases I've taken them off the website because I feel that they would be irresponsible just to throw out there without saying, hey, unless you're in like pretty good health, this may be damaging to you rather than beneficial.
That's very responsible of you, man. Very humble and responsible of you to say that, you know.
It's a tricky situation because, you know, of course I want to provide people what they want. But as a health professional, I have to provide them what they need. And often they don't know what they need. They come to me saying, I need to get stronger. I need to get fitter. But when we go through the process and look at the assessment results, it's like, well, yeah, we can work on that. But first, let's ensure that the fascia is healthy, that the breathing is functional, that you're able to move well without pain, without stiffness, without chronic muscle tension. And that when we get to that place, then we can talk about fitness. Then we can talk about performance and getting super strong and doing more of the high intensity stuff. But until those risks are lowered, then I can't responsibly say to you, push to your maximum level.
Yeah, you need a base to work off of, right? Like the base needs to be healthy. The structure needs to be healthy before you're starting to do these high intensity activities. You touched on fascia. Where are you at with like myofascial release and stuff like that type of things?
It's been a consistent part of my programs for the majority of the time that I've been putting stuff out, I would say. I've increased my frequency of providing that kind of information. And so what I will generally do now is when I'm looking at taking on a new client on a one-on-one basis, I'll be starting off by getting them to do a full body myofascial release for at least a month to clear the myofascial adhesions.
No kidding.
And so, yeah, and people don't particularly like that, but it's my role as a coach and a health practitioner to say, you know, we can put aside a month for this and see how it goes.
Well, and it's just like what you said before. It's
what
like
we what do after that is going to be way better.
Yeah, like it's not what you want, it's what you need. I loved how you said that right there, you know. Are you doing that with mostly like foam rollers, massage guns? How are you doing that?
Yeah, the vast majority of it is with trigger point balls, so like a lacrosse ball, and foam rollers. Sometimes some manual release with the hands as well, like some self massage.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. I will say, I have a standing desk. I'm not standing right now, but when I'm working, I'll have a lacrosse ball for my foot. Freaking love it, man. Mm. And it seems as though if I'm not regular with that, I have more tendency for plantar fasciitis sometimes, seems like.
Yeah, I heard that in one of your previous, I don't know if it was a video or a previous podcast, but I think it's a very common thing for hikers, and for sure the number one thing you can do is to get some activity happening on the plantar fascia and to start loosening up that what is part of the superficial back line, which runs all the way up through the back of the legs, through the spine, even all the way to the top of the head. And if you think about fascia as, it's kind of like a plastic bag that encompasses the whole musculoskeletal system. And it's kind of the analogy that I love is like a tablecloth. So if you imagine a tablecloth set for, you know, Christmas dinner with plates, cups, knives, forks, everything. If you were to pull on one corner of that tablecloth, then it's going to affect all of the other bodies on that table. And it's the same thing that happens in the body. So if there's a restriction in the plantar fascia or any other point for that matter, it's going to be occurring. What is going to be occurring is a restriction somewhere else along that chain, perhaps in several different parts of that chain. And so the key message here is that nothing in the body operates independently.
Totally.
That's why doing a single stretch for a muscle or a single strength movement for one muscle, it can be beneficial, but also it's not really teaching the whole system to understand its own movement capabilities. And so that's why like a lot of the stuff that I do now is very total body based and movement based, rather than just isolating one area of the body to stretch it or release it or to strengthen it.
Yes. Dude, first of all, folks, if you had any doubts that Chase didn't know his stuff, you gotta listen to his podcast. This guy's dropping knowledge bombs left and right. But I have been studying anatomy and phys right now because I'm going to be doing kind of like a side gig with my buddy, and as a corrective movement specialist type of thing. And that's one of the things that I learned was, you know, especially if your knee hurts. It's probably not your knee. It's probably somewhere else in your body that's out of whack, out of balance, that has, you know, caused that pain. And so when you made that analogy of like the, you know, the kitchen cloth or the table, everything, one thing always affects another thing in the body, it seems as though.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I've been getting really into recently is pain reprocessing therapy. So understanding how the emotional body is interacting with the physical body. So in the East they understand this very well, that emotions and tension can be stored as a physical adhesion or a physical tension. And so this is all still very new to me, but I'm going through some courses now to understand, you know, because I've worked with people for a long time, and you know, we've worked on all these things, and there's still limitations. So I'm like, well, what is there left to work on? And the thing that's left to work on after breathing, after myofascial release, after strength and conditioning and all of these protocols is, well, perhaps it's just in the mind. And it sounds kind of dismissive to say that, like, oh, it's just in your head. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that the mind and the body is actually one entity, and it's very clear that the restrictions or the limitations placed on the emotional component of the brain in particular can be represented in the physical body. And to deny that is just stupid, really, in my opinion. Like, if you think about, if I told you right now to think about biting into a lemon, just think about hoofing into a lemon. What happens?
What happens? I would be like, shit. I'd probably be like,
yeah. So that's a physical. Yeah. That's one physical physical response, but also probably what you find is that you salivate. So even just the idea, having the thought in the mind of biting into a lemon.
I see. Yeah.
That's producing a response from the for body, sure, where the brain is interpreting. The brain doesn't know the difference between reality and what you think. So it's going to respond to thoughts and emotions and feelings. So, you know, this is getting so far away from what would be perceived as relevant to hiking. But what's relevant to health is the whole body, yeah, and that includes the mind.
Ah.
Yeah, I'm nowhere near knowledgeable enough to talk about it on a deeper level. So maybe it's better that we come back to this. But it's been super interesting for me, you know, experimenting with the more Eastern philosophies,
right,
and meditation, yoga in particular.
Well, like I said before, I mean, man, if you guys are interested in working with Chase, I'm going to leave some his links down in the show notes below. But as you can kind of see, I mean, from what our whole conversation today, this is a very holistic approach. Like he's not just focusing on one thing. We are focusing on how this affects this part of the body, that affects this part of the body, and taking it from all these different elements of the things. And so with that, dude, I really respect people that do that. And yeah, I mean, you really showed today, like in this podcast, how knowledgeable you are with this subject. So I appreciate you coming on with this, man. Thank you. This was this was super, super enlightening for me. And yeah, how can people catch up with you, or where can they find you to sign up for coaching or YouTube, all that stuff?
So what I'm doing at the moment with this very holistic approach is that it's very difficult, if not almost impossible, to just put this out as a program that has no interaction with me, which is what I've done for the last maybe 6 years. I mainly focus my time on producing a program that could be bought on a website, and you know, it's a PDF or an app or whatever, and people just self-guide. The reality is with this stuff is that it's very complex, and it takes a lot of going back and forth and trial and error and processes. So what I've done since limiting my the amount of videos that I'm putting out on YouTube and Instagram, I've really dialed back from that. Excuse me. And I've put much more time and effort into working with people one-on-one. And so that is called the Hike Flow Method. There's no information on this online at the moment because I'm just very selective about who I take in. So it's usually people that just reach out to me with a problem.
Interesting.
And I'm like, okay, let's workshop that. So that's the Hike Flow Method. And then I'm going to clear my throat.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, if you go to my website, chasemountains.io, there you'll find one membership called Momentum, which is the closest thing to the Hike Flow Method. And I am tentatively putting more of this information in there for people that pay it's either a monthly subscription or an annual fee, whatever works for you best. But then there's all of my back catalogs, yeah, from as early as, I think the earliest program was maybe 2015, wow, but I've been making programs since 2013. Nice. So there's a couple that I've retired, and I'll continue to retire them when I see that they're perhaps the information is a little bit outdated, but they're the sort of the cheaper ones. The first ones that really kicked things off with was Elements, and that's still $35, I think, for a once off fee. So that's a great place to start. And you know, it's not necessary or the ideal thing for people to come in and do one-on-one coaching with me, because my time is limited and I don't undercharge either. So for someone that has the resources and the will and the desire to change, then just reach out to me directly and we'll have a chat.
Dude, the thing that I really respect about you, and that's been very apparent in this podcast, is you are on the cutting edge of a lot of the research, and you are not so close-minded at all to where you're like, nope, this is the way you do it. You are very open in the fact of allowing new information to come in, new things to inform you with different ways of doing things. And those are the people that I really look up to and respect in any sort of discipline. I used to do jiu-jitsu quite frequently, and you know, the coaches that were always they got their black belts, right, which is kind of the end of the road, but they'd still do research on techniques and they'd still be learning and stuff. Like, those were the coaches I wanted to be around because they were constantly getting in new information, and that's exactly what it sounds like you're doing in this type of stuff. And so, yeah, I just want to say that a lot of respect for me from there.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. And I very much appreciate you asking me on. And I would encourage you particularly, but also anyone else who wants to be the next Chase Mountains, my position at the top of this food chain of hiking fitness is up for grabs. And I would welcome competition because it's been far too long without anyone really challenging me. Or sounds very arrogant to say that, but I think that's kind of the truth. Like, there's no one else that's really been so specific about hiking.
Yeah.
Sure, there's mountain athlete, there is training for new alpinism and guys that are more into the alpinism mountaineering side. But as far as hiking is concerned, I feel like there is so much more room for yourself and other people who have a deep interest in health and fitness and a deep desire to help people. Come at me. Like, we need more people in this space, because hiking is a fundamental human movement pattern. Walking long distances is something that is inherent to the human experience. We've been carrying our children, we've been carrying our supplies and moving around this world for as long as we've been around, and sadly we're losing it. And so my work is about enabling that inherited ability, which we all have. And to speak about what you mentioned earlier, as far as being the trail being your training, yeah, absolutely. But if you run into problems, then that's just a sign from the body that there's something that needs to be worked on. And I'm happy to help with that. And like I said, yeah, we need more people in this space. So
yeah,
get into it.
Get into it. Cool. Awesome, dude. All right.
I'm looking to hire coaches as well. I'm looking to hire good coaches.
Interesting.
So please reach out to me.
Interesting. Maybe we'll talk off podcast about